Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This week we sit down with a couple of advocates for rural health care. Hospitals in less populated areas are vital, but they face a host of problems. We'll discuss those and some possible solutions. An investigation has raised more questions about the deputy charged with shooting a black woman in her Springfield home. He's been charged with first-degree murder. Turns out he was discharged from the Army for what was termed serious misconduct. Northern Illinois had a record-setting day earlier this month when it comes to tornadoes. Illinois is well ahead of its normal number of the storms in a year. We'll talk with a state climatologist. We'll also hear how student members of school boards can raise issues their classmates are concerned about. And East St. Louis is a town that's seen plenty of hard times. A nonprofit wants to turn things around through new homes. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. People who live in rural areas may face barriers to accessing health care in their communities. From hospital closures to obstetric deserts, these issues have continued to create health disparities among rural populations who often suffer from obesity, heart disease, poverty, and more. The program Reset checked in with some rural health leaders in Illinois to understand how the barriers create real health consequences for people and what needs to change. Host Sasha Ann Simons spoke with Michelle Rathman, CEO of Impact Communications, and Carissa Turner, board chair of the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network and CEO of the Wabash General Hospital in Mount Carmel.
Michelle, I'll start with a basic question here to get us all on the same page. Define what a rural area is. What are the characteristics?
The information on that keeps changing depending on the census. But what I can tell you is that for rural hospitals, the area they cover often is large swaths of land without a nearby hospital, and sometimes between 35, 50, 85 miles away. So I just came from a very frontier community. Mm-hmm. Other rural communities may be, you know, out on a peninsula on the state of Washington here in Illinois. Anyone who knows, if you drive south of 80, most of the landscape is rural. So just think about, you just talked about bird flu, where the farms are, and that's what rural is defined as. But for healthcare, there's a lot more detail to that.
Carissa, how would you describe Mount Carmel? Tell us about your community.
So Mount Carmel is a population of around 7,200. We're located about 5 hours south of Chicago, and we are approximately 45 minutes away from Evansville, Indiana, which would be defined as an urban location. So we are a sole provider here in our county, and we also help other surrounding counties with their healthcare needs.
You're the CEO of Wabash General Hospital. You've been working there for your entire career. What's it like being a leader at a rural hospital, Carissa? And who are you serving?
It's a lot of pressure, to be honest. I'm living here in the community where I work. We employ 580 employees. So we are the economic engine of the community. We are the largest employer. So there's a lot of pressure there, a lot of families that rely on the decisions that I make here and our team at the hospital. Mm-hmm. We're not only serving patients, but we're serving our community. And we also serve a lot of other organizations, non-for-profits and schools that are lacking the funds that they need to be successful. So a lot of pressure from an employer standpoint, mm-hmm. and also with patient care.
Yeah, Michelle, you've been working with people like Carissa at hospitals in rural communities, and you've been doing this for decades. So does the picture that she's painting sound familiar?
Yes, it does. And Carissa, it's so nice to hear your voice, because the two of us trek to Washington, D.C. every year to advocate for policy that makes sure rural hospitals cannot just, survive, but rather thrive. And I have been doing it. I've worked in about 43 states. And we do have a saying, the kind of hospital that Carissa leads is a critical access hospital. And when I started, there was about almost 1,400. And we've had about 160 or so that have either closed or they've had to remodel themselves to become really just a freestanding emergency room. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, usually the first or the second largest employer, maybe with the exception of a corporate farm, for example, or a processing plant, food processing plant, And there is a lot of pressure, a lot of financial pressure. And so, as Carissa says, the community relies on the hospital, not just for access to health care, emergency care, primary care, and all that we rely on, but the pressures that are coming to them for, with financial constraints, these are things that community members don't understand. So as I said, it is so complicated. If you've seen one critical access hospital, one rural community, you truly have just seen one.
Yeah. I want to stick with you for a moment here, Michelle, and talk more about some of those unique barriers to accessing healthcare that rural communities face specifically. Mm-hmm. So you talked about economic challenges. I know hospital closures are an issue nationwide. What else is on the list?
Well, we have, just as urban centers have, we have staffing shortages, and the struggle to recruit in rural is real. And the pain is a bit different in rural because it doesn't offer the same kind, although it's great places to work and live and people think of recreation, but it doesn't offer some of the opportunities that many who are coming out of medical school, kind of have envisioned for themselves. And so that's why kind of rural medicine tracks are so important to nourish and invest in and make sure that we are bringing rural-minded candidates into the fold. So staffing, but we're also talking about staffing for dietary positions, housekeeping positions, billing office, of course, IT, the demands on IT talent. And unfortunately, rural communities are experiencing, while we do hear about people coming back to rural, they still predominantly experience what we refer to as brain drain. And mm-hmm. So where does that talent come from that understands the local culture? So there's staffing shortages. Of course, everyone is familiar with the cybersecurity threats. I've said often that a cyber threat, a cyber attack on a rural hospital truly is the kiss of death, and there is no lifeline for them. And of course, we've got things like if it's healthcare, then insurance has got to be in the mix. We've got Medicare Advantage plans that are just really squeezing the breath out of rural hospitals, mm-hmm. and that's another whole issue. And then, of course, OB deserts. That goes along with workforce, but we are seeing women and families have to travel for miles upon miles just for prenatal care. Yeah. So the issues are... The list is long. I will say the resiliency is high as well, but we cannot continue to expect our rural hospitals that really they play such a significant role in the greater healthcare landscape in this country because, Sasha, when a rural hospital closes, the people who, like Carissa's community, the thousands that she serves, they don't stop needing healthcare. They right. have to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I think these are things that we really need to be considering. Not in the long run, because it's facing us right here and now.
Well, Carissa, Michelle just sort of ran through the lengthy list of challenges there, but can you talk about health disparities? Are there health issues that disproportionately affect rural populations?
Absolutely. Typically rural, at least in our area, is low income. Transportation seems to be a major factor. Fresh produce and access to healthy options an issue. As we all know, the grocery store prices continue to increase. Processed foods are cheaper. So obesity tends to be a factor in people's health that may not be as severe in an urban environment.
Michelle, I'm curious what impact the COVID pandemic had on rural healthcare systems.
Well, it's so interesting because I was an early adopter of sounding the alarms because I knew how challenging it would be down the road. And at first it was interesting because, there was a lot of talk about, hey, listen, you want us to social distance. You can't get more social distance than living in a rural remote community or somewhere in the plains or what have you. And of course, there was early money that came in to support hospitals and their need to kind of stockpile and replenish their PPE and things of that nature. But at the end of the day, that money, as does if we think about grant cycles and things like that, it dries up. And so there was a kind of, and I dare to call it a boon because it wasn't. It was, hospitals have been so underfunded, underinvested in for so long. And so what happened when that money dried up and it was time to kind of pay the piper, if you will, and we lost so much healthcare workforce. And when you think about it, when you can't spare a single nurse because you have to be compliant with staffing ratios, for one example, and now you're paying exorbitant fees for travelers. That money has to come from somewhere, and it's certainly not coming from revenues because, as Chris has said, so much of the population's critical access and rural hospitals serve are those who are underinsured or uninsured or rely heavily on Medicare and Medicaid, and then we have the whole expansion conundrum as well.
Right.
So I'm a real downer when it comes to cocktail party conversation because there's a lot of challenges.
I can imagine, but that's reality. Now, I want to go back to something you brought up earlier, Michelle, which is policy. So let's dig in here. Is it doing enough? You talked about some policy that was in place to support rural healthcare. Is it doing enough? Has there been policy that's maybe hurt rural healthcare?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you can't escape it. I actually sit on the National Rural Health Association Policy Congress, and, you know, we gather four times a year and we talk about the things that, you know, it's adding policy to protect rural hospitals and addressing policy that has hurt rural hospitals. And so when you think about things, and for your listeners, there's a program called 340B, for example. And really what that is a drug discount program that critical access hospitals rely heavily on. It's in the courts. And so, you know, at the end of the day, the rural hospitals end up kind of footing the bill and waiting for there to be resolve. When you think about policies that are tied to just staffing ratios in nursing homes, this is a big controversy and kind of a fight right now because we don't have the same number of employees to meet the needs of what someone in an office has made a decision about how many aides and nurses have to be in the same facility as the patient. So those are just a few of the examples, but certainly regulatory burdens are a significant issue. Every time something is mandated with respect to new health electronic health records or things of that nature, these require significant investments where the vast majority of rural hospitals in this country do not have a vault with an extra stipend of cash to cover these charges. They have to try and make up for it in other ways that just simply do not exist.
Carissa, during the pandemic, the federal government rolled out the Affordable Connectivity Program, and it provided $30 monthly subsidies for internet bills for low-income and rural families. That funding's now done. Have you seen the change impact families where you live and work?
I honestly have not changed in the families here. The one thing that I have seen a change since COVID that has impacted our community is with the remote workforce. You know, in the past, in a rural community, most of your talent stayed within that community and didn't really seek employment elsewhere. And that's really been something that has hindered our facilities since COVID. A lot of the workforce has went remote. And now there's not only a shortage of talent nationwide, especially with physicians, but a deeper shortage and crisis here within our small communities and rural hospitals.
So what would you say needs to change?
There needs to be a focus on rural residency programs that was mentioned earlier. Something that we see is our talent pool here is originated within our local community through our high schools. We offer a lot of dual credit classes, but then you don't see a lot of medical schools or residency programs in a community that has a critical access hospital. So what happens? Our physicians that are produced here within the community go on to an urban environment. They start families, they get comfortable, and the residency programs then start heavily recruiting them, and then they never return to their home population. So that's been a major challenge for us, is just to have providers that are willing to live within the community and serve their hometown. We've tried with our foundation. We do have a donor program that is specifically for scholarships for physicians, and we try to identify those candidates early on before they leave the community so that they will return and come back. But that alone has not solved our problem. We could use some additional help, whether that be with policymaking or innovative ideas how we can get
residents or medical students back in small communities.
We'll have to leave it there. Carissa Turner is the CEO of Wabash General Hospital in Mount Carmel, Illinois, and Michelle Raffman is CEO of the Rural Health Strategy Advisory Firm Impact Communications. Thank you both.
In the coming week, July 30th, will mark the centennial of civil rights leader C.T. Vivian's birth. He grew up in Macomb, and the community is planning to mark the occasion, Rich Egger reports.
The celebration of the Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian will take place downtown. Works from his art collection will be displayed at the Macomb Arts Center starting at 5 o'clock. It's the first time they've been shown publicly. Then at 7, a program including speakers and music will be held in front of the C.T. Vivian mural. City Council member Byron Odin Shabazz is involved with the plans to celebrate and honor Vivian.
You're talking about somebody that had impact on a movement that changed the country, some of its laws, some of its rights and privileges, more equity, opportunity, and inclusion.
Odin Shabazz says Vivian brought about change, not through the use of force, but by emphasizing peace and love. Vivian participated in his first demonstration in 1947. He went on to be one of the leaders of the American Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and 60s, working alongside the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. President Barack Obama awarded Vivian the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2013. It's the nation's highest civilian award. Vivian passed away in Atlanta in July of 2020, just a couple weeks before his 96th birthday. Rich Egger reporting.
Governor J.B. Pritzker has signed legislation imposing new regulations on the carbon capture industry that involves injecting CO2 emissions underground to reduce air pollution. Christine Nannicelli with the Sierra Club in Illinois says they support the new rules because they go further than current federal law. But she says they'd wanted a measure to protect the Mahomet Aquifer.
Illinois Clean Jobs Coalition proposed a ban on injection through the Mahomet Aquifer. That's what we supported and fought for. That was unfortunately not something we were able to reach agreement on with other stakeholders.
The aquifer is federally recognized as the sole source of water for much of central Illinois. State Senator Chapin Rose says a ban for the aquifer should have been part of the new rules. He's filed legislation to put that ban in place. We'll have more on Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Science has been studying the growing of crops for a long time, but the study of soil, that's relatively new. Researchers are finding there's a lot to be learned about how farming has impacted soil over the decades. And as Jim Meadows reports, that research could be greatly helped by the discovery of soil samples over a century old.
On a Sunday morning in August of 2018, University of Illinois soil scientist Andrew Margonaut drove out to a dilapidated barn on the campus farm. Inside, using a headlamp to pierce the darkness, Margonaut discovered a treasure trove.
I realized within about 5 minutes of walking through these cobwebbed, very dark hallways that there were row upon row, shelf upon shelf of soils, and that these were the original soils taken in the mapping of the state.
There were thousands of soil samples stored in mason jars and other sealed containers going back as far as the 1860s. The soil, taken from nearly every Illinois county, mostly in the early 1900s, was used to map soil types and help farmers determine growing conditions. The collection was orphaned in 2003 after the death of the last researcher to work with it. Professor Margonaut says his rediscovery sent his mind reeling with the research possibilities.
I didn't sleep for about two nights because I was so excited by all the things that we could answer.
Margonaut is contacting farmers and landowners so he can take new soil samples in the same locations. He wants to study how the soil has changed over more than a century to learn about long-term changes in nutrients, microbial activity, and soil stability. That's a rare opportunity. U.S. Department of Agriculture soil scientist Mark Liebig says the soil samples in most soil archives are less than 40 years old.
The average human lifespan now is right around 73 years. With the exception of a few places across the globe, we really don't know how the soil changes over that duration of time.
Liebig says he believes many older soil archives that did exist have been lost either forever or until they're found again. At Penn State University, another collection showed up in a storage closet 4 years ago. The samples date from 1915 and 1933 from a now-demolished test plot on campus. Rita Grafe with Penn State's Pasto Agricultural Museum says nowadays they can analyze the soils in new ways, even reviving the soil's dormant microbes.
But we need to preserve these collections because in the future, there might be technologies that let us further understand what was happening in the soil then so that we can make decisions going forward.
We also have the Morrow plot samples going back to 1904 up here as well.
Okay.
So it's a
at the University of Illinois today, thousands of jars of soil line shelves in a much newer barn. Marcinot picks one up.
And this one, for example, this is a good example of a jar where the label is not in great shape, as you can see.
But a little paper inside the jar gives more information. Marcinot is using all that data to reach out to landowners and ask permission to take new soil samples at more than 450 specific locations. So far, he's gotten around 60. One of those new samples comes from John Kiefner's farm southwest of Chicago.
I see it as an avenue for me to maybe get more educated and become a little smarter. I'm really curious to see how this soil has changed from 1957 to 2024.
Kiefner adopted no-till farming more than three decades ago. He hopes to learn that he's actually improved his soil, or at least not harmed it. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jim Meadows.
The National Weather Service has confirmed the Chicago and Rockford areas saw 27 tornadoes touch down on July 15th alone. That brings the statewide total to over 100 this year, already surpassing the annual average of 50. To discuss the implications, Melba Gomez spoke with the Illinois State climatologist Trent Ford.
And Trent, let's just jump right into it. Can you explain why we've seen so many tornadoes this year?
Yeah, so, you know, when we get a lot of tornadoes in any given year, we tend to get a larger scale environmental setup. I'm talking large scale, like continental scale, weather environment setup, where we get northwest flow. So air moving over a big ridge in the western U.S., moving from northwest to southeast across the Midwest, combined with really strong southerly flow from the Gulf of Mexico. And so bringing us kind of humid, warm air from the Gulf of Mexico. And when that cooler air from the Northwest hits that warmer, more humid air from the Gulf of Mexico, we get that clash of air masses. And that can create the kind of conditions that are conducive to not just creating one storm with one tornado, but multiple rounds of storms with many tornadoes.
And Trent, I know you're a climatologist and not a weatherman, but can I ask you, what does the forecast look like? Could we be seeing more tornadoes this year, or are we now in the clear?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, when we look at kind of the climatological frequency of tornadoes, we see the peak frequency between April and June, and it really falls off in the fall. In fact, the fewest tornadoes occur in September and October. We'll have to see what comes of that. You know, August overall, the outlooks are showing a dry pattern for much of the central U.S., but it's really about, again, those two pressure systems. What's going on in the western U.S., what's going on with the Bermuda High off the coast of the southeast and the Atlantic. And so what that means is that for August and maybe into September, we could have the potential to see that kind of large-scale setup like what we saw in July. It's likely not going to be as persistent. So the chances, perhaps, if we want to put it in kind of probability terms, of getting that kind of big storm, big tornado outbreak like what we saw last week may not be as large as it was in July, because we may not get the persistence day after day after day, but the potential is still there.
We do hear a lot about climate change causing more frequent extreme weather events. What role do you think climate change plays when it comes specifically to tornadoes?
Yeah, that connection is not as strong, or we don't have it as much information highlighting that connection between climate change and tornadoes or hail or those kind of isolated severe weather types of events, as there is with something like climate change and extreme heat. That being said, there is a lot. I mean, the research over the last 10 years has advanced so far, and mainly that's advancements in modeling and computing, where we can start to resolve some of these features of these storms that happen not at the large scale, like what I was just talking about, but at finer scales, maybe within the Chicagoland region. And so some of that research is suggesting that there may be a connection between climate change, especially into the future, and the frequency of tornado events, especially the frequency of those environments that I just talked about that are conducive to producing many tornadoes, like what we saw last week.
You know, Trent, we saw actually one of the tornadoes was at O'Hare Airport, and people think that urban areas are not going to get tornadoes. But are we going to see developed areas actually seeing more tornadoes?
Yeah, first let me dispel the rumor that tornadoes can occur in big cities. We saw 27 tornadoes, including I think something like 8 or 10 in Chicago proper. Everybody is vulnerable to tornadoes. Tornadoes can occur anywhere in Illinois, so we'll just dispel that right off the bat. One of the issues is that irrespective of what happens with changing frequency of tornadoes and the connection with climate change, we know our urban and developed spaces are getting geographically larger. The Chicagoland region is expanding, but even down here in Champaign-Urbana, we're expanding. So what that means is that if a tornado sets down today in the state of Illinois or in the Chicagoland region, it has a much higher likelihood of running into something or someone than it did 50 or 60 years ago. And so what that means is that, again, irrespective of what happens with climate change and tornado frequency, we need to be making sure that we're not manufacturing vulnerability by the way we're developing our urban and our lived spaces.
Trent Ford is the Illinois State Climatologist. Trent, it is always great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, likewise. Thank Melba.
How can school boards represent all student voices, from elementary schoolers up through high school? Some Northern Illinois school districts use student board members to bring the issues that students are dealing with to the table. Peter Medlin has more.
Bathroom soaps and paper towels are not refilled often. Some other concerns that were brought up were like an unbalanced grading system.
Jenna Zimmerman lists off student concerns. She's a student at DeKalb High School heading into her senior year next year, and also the district's second ever student school board member. She's the link between the elected board and nearly 7,000 students from preschool to high school. If you think about it, she represents more people than a lot of mayors. And these concerns she brought to the board, like bathroom access, unfair dress codes, and a test-heavy grading system, are issues you could hear at a lot of different schools, but they don't always get taken seriously enough to make it all the way to the school board. That's Jenna's job.
There's so many students who want to make change, and I just feel like they don't know where to start.
In some ways, she's the voice of DeKalb students, but it's almost impossible to hear from everyone and speak on behalf of everyone in such a large and diverse district. One way she's trying to hear students who want to make change is through speakouts, where they invite students from every school to talk about challenges they're facing. It's how she got the responses she presented, and she's also created a mini board made up of fellow students.
I chose a specific amount of seniors, juniors, sophomores, and freshmen just to make it around an equal amount of people who are actively coming to mini board meetings and sharing their voice.
She had around 20 students last year and hopes to get to 40 next year for a more representative sample. And DeKalb is not the only school district with student school board members. At Rockford Public Schools, they have a student advisory council of about a dozen students from all the district's high schools. Jessica Garcia just graduated from Auburn High School, and she was on the council for the past 2 years. Her school has academies, and the Gifted Academy is always the most represented on the board. But she thought, what about everybody else? What about the students who aren't in every club or every sport?
So I felt like it was really important to elevate student experience that wasn't, you know, high achieving students. You know, there's other students who aren't like that, and they deserve to have their voices represented as well.
And to that point, what about younger students? Student board members are almost always high schoolers. Elementary and middle schoolers often don't have their voices heard or taken seriously. Garcia says one way they're trying to hear from those kids is through a fifth grade mentorship program. And they also applied for a grant to buy books for elementary school students.
How can we get younger students kind of involved, or kind of like what's an issue that a lot of children are facing right now? And that's reading. Reading scores are insanely low.
Back in DeKalb, Zimmerman says she visited both middle schools last year to talk with students and hopes to invite middle and elementary schoolers to mini board meetings next year. The Aurora West School District has had student board representatives for almost 20 years. Ellie Rogowski is a student board member, and she says their district has built some infrastructure that helps students and staff know who their student representatives are. For example, civics classes do an assignment where they research and write down all of their representatives, starting with Congress.
At the bottom of that chart, they had to go and research and find out who their student board representatives are.
Jenna Zimmerman in DeKalb says they brought a lot of important issues to the board this past year, like bringing in new AP classes and bringing back their mandatory study hall. And those discussions will continue into next year, but they did have a few big wins. They helped lead the charge for a new lunch program.
Through the mini board, we were also able to send a few students out to different schools to go taste the different programs that they were going to use next year.
In her last board meeting as a member in Rockford, Jessica Garcia talked about teen dating violence and a new Illinois law that corrects some language about students having the right to a safe learning environment.
Being able to hear that firsthand testimony is really important to bringing about some change.
Conversations like that can be powerful. If schools say they want to hear honest student voices, students say schools have to be prepared to listen to things that might be hard to hear, but do keep giving them the space to share. I'm Peter Mudlin.
Well, the 2024 Olympics are now getting underway in Paris. Several of the athletes representing the U.S. are from right here in Illinois, including Tori Franklin. She's a triple jumper in the track and field event. It's her second Olympic experience. And Franklin sat down with Noah Jennings to discuss her early days in Chicago's suburbs and her goals in Paris.
There's so many events under the umbrella of track and field. When you were first getting started, how did you determine that the triple jump was the one for you?
Oh, that's funny. I was actually avoiding the triple jump. I did not want to do the triple jump. I wanted to do pole vault, and I had been dreaming of doing pole vault for a few years. And right as I was learning how to hold the pole correctly, the triple jump coach came over to me and said, no, we're going to do this. And I was like, I don't even know what that is. But, you know, it's stuck since then. So I'm grateful.
And so you spent those days training out in the burbs. You first attended Glenbrook North High School and then later Downers Grove South. When you think back to that time in your life, what memories jump out at you?
I remember the sense of community. My team was really important to me, especially by my senior year. I was captain, and I had the opportunity to give like motivational speeches to the team, and we were just a really close group, and that's something I really cherish.
This is your second Olympics appearance. You were featured in the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. What are some lessons that you learned during your experience in Tokyo that you're taking with you to Paris?
What I'm taking with me to Paris is to just relax, be free, have fun, and ultimately whatever will be, will be. You know, I prepared my body to the best of my ability. I prepared my mind. And at this point, it's just going out there, having fun, and showing the world what you're made of.
Now, when you're out there competing and you're about to pull off a triple jump, can you walk us through sort of what the key elements are in your mind to nail the perfect triple jump?
For me personally, I am an athlete of speed. There are some triple jumpers that are power jumpers. There are some that have both, but I'm a speed jumper. So that's my superpower. And that's my focus, is to bring the speed down the runway, to be light, to be tall, and everything else will take care of itself.
When you're away from the track, I know that you're a public speaker and you're also recently a published author. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I've been public speaking since maybe my freshman year of college. I was inspired by my high school coach at the time, Timothy Pinnick, and I've always just wanted to share the message of self-love, self-confidence, and recognizing your divinity in connection with all that is. And I talk a lot about that in my book, You Anthem, and it focuses mostly on the mental wellness and mental health journey and how I've used these different techniques to become a world championship bronze medalist.
So obviously, once the Olympics starts, you'll want to find yourself on the podium. But beyond that, do you have any additional goals for yourself in Paris?
My focus, honestly, is the competition, which makes sense. To just make sure I'm executing, staying relaxed, not getting caught up in the craziness and the parade of the Olympics. Getting on that podium. Outside of that, my family's going to be there. So I'm excited to show them some of my favorite places from when I used to live in Paris. But all of that comes secondary.
That's Olympic triple jumper and Illinois native Tori Franklin. She spoke with Noah Jennings. You can catch Franklin in the women's triple jump qualifying. That happens August 2nd at 11:15 a.m. Central Time. Statewide brings you reports and conversations from in and around Illinois each week through this station. On the way, some new details in the case of Sonia Massey, a black woman who was fatally shot by a sheriff's deputy in Springfield. That's coming
up next.
This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On July 6th, shortly after midnight, Sonia Massey, a black woman living in Springfield, was shot in the face and killed by a now former Sangamon County Sheriff's Deputy, Sean Grayson. Massey dialed 911 after thinking a prowler was outside of her home. Grayson, who is white, is now facing murder charges after being fired by the sheriff's office. Farrah Anderson is an investigative reporting fellow with Illinois Public Media, the Invisible Institute, and the Investigative Reporting Workshop. And she spoke with Kimberly Schofield about her reporting on previously uncovered records regarding Grayson's military discharge and misconduct.
Farrah, when and where did Grayson serve in the military?
Grayson was a U.S. Army soldier who was stationed at Fort Riley, which is in Kansas. He was there until 2016, where he was discharged for serious misconduct, according to the military records that we obtained from a former police department in Illinois that he worked at. Now, it's not clear exactly what this misconduct was. We've asked the U.S. military exactly what this misconduct was and if they could expand on that, but they said that that would be a privacy violation and that they can't disclose more about what that misconduct exactly was. But we are filing more records requests to see if we can get more information about what kind of serious misconduct led to his discharge from the U.S. Army.
And when and where did Grayson serve as law enforcement before Sangamon County?
So he started as a part-time law enforcement officer in Pawnee, which is in central Illinois, kind of near Springfield. So he started there in 2020. So he's only been in law enforcement for about 4 years. He's been at 6 different departments within those 4 years in Illinois. He started in 2020 and he was in Pawnee for about a year and he left in 2021. Then he continued working at the Kincaid Police Department, where he had been working as a part-time officer until the middle of 2021. He then jumped to Verdon and was there for a little less than a year. Then he jumped to the Auburn Police Department, where he became a full-time officer. He stayed there for a little under a year. Then he went to the Logan County Sheriff's Office, where he was again a full-time officer for about a year. And then he finally landed at the Sangamon County Sheriff's Office in 2023. And he was separated right after the killing of Massey this month. So he's been at 6 different police departments in the past 4 years, all in central Illinois specifically.
When exactly did he start in Sangamon County? And does he have a history on the job there?
So he started in Sangamon County in 2023, and he was separated in 2024. So he was a sheriff's deputy. We still have records requests out with the Sangamon County Sheriff's Office. So we don't know exactly what his history looked like, whether there were complaints filed or any disciplinary charges. So we're still waiting on those files to confirm whether or not he had any discipline issues at Sangamon County before he killed Massey. So we're still waiting on those.
What has been the response to the shooting? And has the sheriff responded to questions about why he hired a deputy with such a record?
So we haven't gotten a response back from the Sangamon County Sheriff's Office about these misconduct allegations from the U.S. Army. We're still looking to see kind of what they knew about his discharge and his serious misconduct before they hired him, considering the fact that, you know, these records predate his employment at all of these different police departments throughout Illinois. The Sangamon County Sheriff's Office did fire him after this shooting and has released a statement saying that his actions do not reflect the values and the training of that department. The Illinois State Police has also released the body cam footage. They've had use of force experts say that he, you know, violated the training that he was given on how to use force. And so now he's been charged with first degree murder, aggravated battery with a firearm, and official misconduct. And so he's now waiting a court date, which should be coming up here in August.
Farah, you're a journalist. You work with organizations that do investigative reporting. Is there any way for the public, though, to look up information on law officers throughout Illinois?
So I think the most important thing to know is that the misconduct files on officers are public record under Calvin v. Chicago, which is an Illinois court case. So these records are public. Any citizen or any journalist can request these records from their police departments to see, which officers have discipline or which officers have misconduct or complaints. This is all public information that you can request. So far, the Invisible Institute has worked to make more of these misconduct records publicly available. So the first two cities that we've worked in are Chicago and Champaign and Urbana. So we have, currently available public-facing data tools where you can look up officers and look at all of their misconduct files, their use of force records, their complaints, and their disciplinary files. So these are records that are publicly available. It's just a matter of waiting after you file those requests.
That's reporter Farah Anderson. That story produced in partnership with the nonprofit newsrooms, Invisible Institute, and the Investigative Reporting Workshop. Sam Stecklow also co-reported the story. Meanwhile, the deputy, Sean Grayson, remains in custody awaiting trial. Federal officials estimate 1 million fewer students will receive the Pell Grant this year. That funding is meant to help America's neediest students afford college. Lisa Kurian-Phillip reports.
The only way to get the Pell Grant is to submit a new version of the Federal Financial Aid Form, or FAFSA, launched this year. And Lynn Baker says it's been a mess. Baker is with the Illinois Student Assistance Commission, which helps residents get funding to attend college.
Many students had significant issues, went in multiple times to try to do this, and some students just gave up and said, I'm just not going to enroll this year.
But Baker says it's not too late to submit the form and get Pell funding. She says her agency is offering virtual sessions to help students through the process so they can head to campus in the fall.
Lisa Kurian-Phillip with that story. A nonprofit religious organization has some big housing plans for East St. Louis. Lansdowne Up wants to build 20 homes at about $360,000 apiece. Will Bauer caught up with the director of the organization, Kevin Green, to talk about the challenges and goals for the group.
If you look at East St. Louis, it's been a long time since we've actually had market rate housing. As an example, the home that I live in is 102 years old. As we've had new housing coming into the city, in many cases, over the last 30, 40 years, it's been new public housing. It's been government-subsidized housing. So we haven't really had a lot of new private homes built in the city. The city basically had to relearn what it's like to work with a developer. And technically, we're not a developer, but we are someone who has come in with private financing to actually build homes in the city. And it's been an interesting challenge, for the city even to get to that point, just because they've been so used to the public subsidized housing.
And what do you hope these homes that you guys are building solve in East St. Louis?
Well, East St. Louis has many, many challenges. So we're hoping that having homes like this will bring in a middle-class population, which East St. Louis used to be a predominantly middle-class city. And if you don't have people, and right now we're down to less than 18,000 people from a high of almost 80, 90,000 people. So here we are now. We've got less than 18,000 people. Many are at or below the poverty line. We need to attract people back to the city. We need to attract the middle class so we can have a tax base. Once you have people and you have a tax base, now the businesses will come back into the city.
It's kind of a good segue into my next question, because I wanted to ask about maybe some of the comments or concerns that I've seen online. And it's that these homes are listed at $360,000. And the median income in East St. Louis, you're probably well aware, sits around $25,000. So some would say, how does a family in East St. Louis, how do they ever afford one of these? What would you say to maybe that concern?
That's a very, very interesting concern, because if you look at that and say, okay, if the homes were $100,000 or $125,000 at $25,000, if that's your income, you probably can't afford a $125,000 home or a $150,000 home. So these homes really are designed to get people to move back into East St. Louis. We have people that have moved out of East St. Louis. We have college graduates. We have tradespeople. We've got really a good middle and upper middle class population that has moved out because they say we just can't find housing in East St. Louis like we may find in some surrounding communities. And many young people don't want to get into a home where they've got to put a lot of sweat equity, a lot of work into, you know, in many cases, they don't have that kind of income to be able to put that money into a home to make it livable immediately. So the homes themselves are not designed for the current population of East St. Louis, and we're pretty adamant about that.
Why is this an important endeavor for y'all at Lansdowne Up?
Our vision is to transform to create a thriving environment in East St. Louis. We really want to see the city revitalized. You know, we'd like to have a revival of people who love God, who love their neighbors, you know, who love their neighborhood. And we want to transform this particular section, which is Lansdowne Park. You know, we're focused right here because we can't do all of East St. Louis. We're a nonprofit. And again, with the population, that's when we can approach some of the businesses. You know, Chick-fil-A will look at East St. Louis and say, I'd like to be there. Quick Trip will look at it. You know, we get a Whole Foods, you know, places like that would actually say, okay, we have the population now that's our demographic that can support our businesses. And so that's our goal, to really bring East St. Louis back into a thriving city, which it once was.
Lansdowne Up director Kevin Green, and he spoke with Will Bauer about efforts to build middle-class homes in East St. Louis. Next month, the Democratic National Convention will come to the United Center in Chicago. Tens of thousands of people, from elected officials to protesters, are expected to pack the arena and surrounding streets. Nearby hospitals are planning for the worst and hoping for the best. Kristen Schorsch has more.
I'm outside the United Center, imagining these big parking lots and streets filled with people. And then something bad happens. The closest hospitals are about a 20-minute walk from here, so I headed over to one of them, Rush University Medical Center. This hospital has an emergency department built for a disaster. I meet Dr. Nicholas Cozy just outside the ER.
We have built a plan to anticipate tens, hundreds, thousands of people coming across the 290 expressway on the bridges in an event of a mass casualty or a major catastrophe.
For 9 months, he's been planning for a lot of different scenarios. An explosion, a truck running people over, a mass shooting. So we go where patients would turn up, the ambulance bay. Cozy opens the door.
So an ambulance comes across Congress Parkway, enters through here. But this is the area that we've designed to be able to decontaminate hundreds of people in a very quick fashion.
The ambulance bay is huge and empty for the moment. Cozy goes through one scenario, how Rush would take care of dozens of people getting pepper sprayed at the convention. He turns on what looks like a giant faucet shooting water up to rinse someone's eyes.
Sorry if I got you.
Then a person would head over to one of several areas separated by heavy curtains. I push some buttons to bring them down from the ceiling. These curtains give people privacy to take off their clothes and get sprayed with warm water and soap to remove any decontaminant. All those nightmare scenarios. Rush built this ER a decade ago for situations just like these.
It's not something that you can walk outside and build a tent for and say, wait, please, let me get to you and let's build this. We have to have it ready to go. And this is turnkey.
Besides Rush, there are two other major hospitals in this medical district, just down the block. Cook County Stroger Hospital and UI Health. Yes, traffic will be a mess next month during the convention. So these hospitals are also planning to make sure other patients can get to them. Women in labor, people having surgery, or someone who gets hurt in a car crash. People who have doctor's visits are being asked if they can see them virtually or at another clinic away from downtown. And few appointments after 3 p.m., when more motorcades might be heading to the United Center, clogging traffic. Shonda Morrow at Rush says some patients are nervous about being seen.
We've not been in a position where we've, for example, denied seeing a patient, or a patient has stated they did not want to come downtown.
And then there's making sure the thousands of people who work at these hospitals can get there. Some might sleep on cots or in student dorms overnight. Morrow is a longtime nurse, a caregiver, and it's something that stays with her as she gets through the next several weeks.
What I hope to bring to this, and hope's not a strategy, right? What I will bring to this is that compassion. What will come easy is caring for our patients. The most difficult part is not having that answer if indeed something catastrophic happens.
Despite all the prep, Craig Williams at nearby Cook County Health says Chicago hospitals deal with big events all the time.
You know, I think the only thing that I'm concerned about is just the general political climate and, you know, thinking that you're going into a, you know, a sitting president going to his national convention doesn't seem like it would be that much of an event.
What makes him nervous is the unpredictable things that come with holding a massive rally for 4 days in this political moment. Kristen Schorsch, WBEC News.
That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. We'll return next week with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.